So eighth and final week on the Anapanasati. As I say, I am planning to do a sort of lead through next week. So rounding off. But this week we're looking at the last stages of the Dharma tetrad. So stages 14, 15 and 16. And as is often the case with the Dharma, the further you go, the less there is to say, or the less easy it is to find anything to say. So it'd be actually fairly brief on the last three stages. But after that, I wanted to say a couple of things about, firstly, about two different approaches to meditation practice more broadly, which is the approach of a path, which is the one that you usually pick up first, and the approach of a mandala, which is one that is often a bit of a surprise to people because it tends not to get taught or presented. And then finally, some words on condensing the practice. So we'll do it in two stages, and I think we'll do a sort of condensed version of the practice at the end of the first half, and then a more sort of open mandala approach in the second half. And I'll say something about that as we go along. Meanwhile, the last three stages of the Dharma tetrad. So stage 14, contemplating dispassion, I breathe in. Contemplating dispassion, I breathe out. Stage 15, contemplating cessation, I breathe in. Contemplating cessation, I breathe out. And stage 16, contemplating relinquishment, I breathe in. Contemplating relinquishment, I breathe out. And these three stages, they follow on from contemplating impermanence. I breathe in, contemplating impermanence, I breathe out, so from the previous week. And there's the pattern there of establishing awareness, establishing practice, and then relaxing into it. So here in this tetrad, we're establishing this contemplation, this awareness of impermanence. And then on the basis of that, there's a sort of momentum of letting go. So seeing through the seeming durability and substantiality of experience, and then from that there's a sort of natural momentum of letting go, which these three stages are sort of the playing out of. So dispassion is viraga, I'll say a bit about that in a moment. Cessation is nirodha, and relinquishment, patinisaga. And they all three follow on from realising impermanence in each other. So let's have a brief pause and let Joy join us. Hello, Joy.
Sorry.
Exactly, yeah. So 14, 15, 16, dispassion, cessation, relinquishment. So just launching into talking about the last stages, which is dispassion, cessation, relinquishment. So dispassion, viraga, is a letting go of attachments. Cessation, nirodha, is the cessation of suffering that's consequent to attachments. So this is the sort of second arrow, the painfulness of negative mental states of reactivity. So if we let go of the reactivity, we're letting go of the painfulness of that reactive mental state, so the tightness of grasping and attachment. And relinquishment, patinisaga, is the relinquishment of any wish to pick those up again, to pick your attachments up again. So it's a relinquishment of ambitions, desires, cravings, attachments. So the basic movement in this tetrad is turning the mind towards impermanence, and then through sort of realising impermanence of experience, there's this natural sequence of letting go that sort of has its own momentum to it. A sort of relaxing into that state of mind that's at home with impermanence. So I wanted to say a little bit more about viraga. It's an interestingly ambiguous word because raga certainly can mean passion, so in that sense it's dispassion. But it can also mean a sort of red dye. Raga can mean a sort of red, bright red dye. So it's a totally different meaning to the word. So in that sense, viraga can mean a sort of fading away, a sort of paling, as the way a sort of dyed fabric in use and over time can gradually fade. And that's a interesting parallel to have in the word there, because you can sort of see, well, a sort of bright red dye is a sort of visual sort of metaphor for passion, and this sort of natural fading over time is a sort of metaphor for a gradual abandoning, a gradual letting go. And it sort of, to me, it sort of brings in a suggestion of this whole Japanese aesthetic that's called wabi-sabi, where there's a sort of sense of the beauty in things, particularly in things imperfect, impermanent, and incomplete. And there's a taste in wabi-sabi for colours that are very subtle, either, and there's a sense of impermanence either in the sense of faded, so after long use, cared for. So something has a lot of use if it's been cared for, if it's been valued and kept. And there's a sense of, in wabi-sabi, that the value of something accrues the more it is valued. So if something's mended, it becomes more valuable because someone's thought it valuable enough to mend. So it's that sort of care that's put into it. So fading can have that actually quite positive aesthetic to it. But also fading away is a phrase that's brought into the way in which experience can just kind of fall open. The sort of tightness and difficulty and dukkha around experience, as there's this sort of opening and letting go, you can see that as a fading away of dukkha. So cessation, the sort of noble truth, really, the noble truth of cessation of dukkha, you can think of that in terms of fading away. And the way that's put is, as you see into the sort of insubstantiality, impermanence, there's no sort of enduring solid core to this sort of knot of difficulty that I find myself in. So if I see through that, there's a sort of disentanglement and a sort of falling open that's involved. And one of the metaphors that gets used is sort of two sheaves of reeds leaning on each other. Imagine out in a field, days before haystacks, they just lean the sheaves of reeds on each other. So that's particularly relevant for the way in which craving and suffering kind of lean on each other. So that's the second noble truth, isn't it? That independence on craving arises suffering. But also, if you remember the spiral path, independence on Vedna arises Trishna. So dukkha is a painful Vedna, and Trishna is a more poetic word that's talking about this grasping, craving, attachment. So the two depend on each other. They're like two sheaves of reeds leaning on each other. And so that can feel like a stuck sort of knot. But from another perspective, all you have to do is take one of those sheaves away and the other will just kind of fall open. So there's this kind of falling open as you see the lack of any sort of inherent substantial solidity to this whole knot that we're in. And as it falls open, then the dukkha kind of gradually abates, and you can see that in terms of a sort of fading. So one final point to make around these last three stages, dispassion, cessation, relinquishment. They're expressed in the negative, but there are positive counterparts. So it's a bit of an easy sort of misunderstanding to fall into, because the path in the early text is so often presented in negative terms as a path of cessation that it's sort of easy to miss that actually there are positive counterparts. So dispassion, it's the absence of greed, but in the absence of greed there's also a space for the presence of loving kindness, of sympathetic joy, of equanimity, of compassion, and also of other positive emotions. Shraddha is another very central positive emotion. So the absence of passions, craving, grasping allows a space for positive emotions to fill. Cessation, nirodha, it's not just less dukkha, but it's also the opportunity, the space for more joy, for more bliss, for more positive, for more enjoyable feelings. And relinquishment, it's a renunciation of ties, of attachments, but it's also opening to a sort of freedom to engage, a sort of freedom to respond, a responsiveness. So there's a sort of suggestion here of the direction of samadhi, and if you're familiar with the, there are three insight samadhis that correspond to dukkha, anicca, anatta, the three lakshanas. So the samadhi that corresponds to the lakshana of dukkha is called the direction of samadhi, and there's a sort of sense of freedom of movement in that. So it's like a mind that doesn't have any grooves or ruts. You're not driven to act in any certain, any particular way. You're sort of free to respond. And this sort of description of relinquishment as the final stage is a suggestion of that. You're letting go of habit patterns, drives, cravings, desires, and it's moving into a more open space that's also got a freedom to respond. So it's a freedom to engage in the world on the basis of inspiration, of responsiveness, of creativity, of the bodhicitta. So in all three ways, it's sort of there's an opening, and the opening is into a space which is there for positive emotions, positive feelings to come in, to respond to. So although the language is negative, there are positive counterparts. So that's the last three stages. That's it in a nutshell. It's perhaps worth dropping in at the end as well that when we present the whole practice as a path, the last stages can seem very remote. And insight can seem like... the way it's presented, it can seem like it's tantamount to enlightenment, and it's not something that we're going to have personal experience of. But actually, insights come in many sizes. There are insights large and small, and they sort of happen. You know, if we practice effectively, if we engage in samatha, if we're open to the Dharma, then insights of varying sizes will just happen occasionally, and it's like seeds being planted, which will flower in time. And I think the thing to draw from teachings such as this, the final stage of the Anapanasati, and the parallel, there's a very clear parallel to the spiral path teaching as well. So the final stage of the spiral path from knowledge and vision of things as they are unfolds in a similar sort of way. You see through, and then there's this kind of opening, this sort of letting go, this relinquishment. And they're sort of both pointing out that there's a natural progression from seeing through to letting go, to abandonment. So insights large and small will be happening from time to time, not all the time, but occasionally, and they're like seeds being planted. They'll sort of flower in time. There's a natural process there. Okay, so that's covered all 16 stages. And as I say, the other couple of things I wanted to draw out this week are, firstly, these two approaches to meditation, the path and the mandala, and secondly, at least one suggested way of condensing the practice down into something more manageable. Okay, so I'll tell you a bit about the path and the mandala. So the sutta is presenting a path model. It's presenting 16 stages in a linear sequence of contemplation. So it's got a start, it's got a middle, and it's got an end. So that's a sort of temporal model. That's a sort of it's a way of looking at experience. That's it's a very temporal way of looking at experience. You do this, and then you do that, and then you do that. So in that model, we're engaging with bhavana practice, which means we've got a feel for conditionality, particularly the sort of creative or spiral mode to conditionality, and the way in which each contemplation reaches a sort of fruition and naturally moves on to the next. And there's a sort of accumulation in a particular sequence going on. So that's the path model. So there is an alternative, which is the mandala model. So here the metaphor is of a mandala, which is a circle with a centre and four quadrants. And mandalas are a sort of spatial symbol, and they symbolise everything, really. They're sort of representing a way of looking at everything. So, as I say, it's a spatial model, and there's nowhere to go because the space includes everything. So we're not going anywhere. So in a sort of mandala approach to meditation, we're not going anywhere because there's nowhere to go. So we don't need to follow any particular prescribed sequence, and we don't have to do all the stages. Yeah, so in this case, all 16 stages. So what we do in a mandala approach to practice is we're following the process of what arises in our experience in the way that it arises, and we're drawing on whatever stages, whatever contemplations feel relevant. So if priti and sukha arise, then we contemplate those arising. If hindrances arise, we welcome them in and we work with them in the way of the experiencing the mind, stage 9. So we're noticing the conditioning effect that these things have on our mind. So with priti and sukha, they're sort of shaping the experience of mind. Yeah, so if you remember stage 7, experiencing the mind, the conditioned mind, the mind that's kind of shaped and conditioned by Vedana. So in order to do this, in order to sort of respond to our experience as it arises with whatever's most appropriate, we need to have all the stages available at our fingertips, sort of familiar and available. And then we can follow this sort of intuitive sense and sort of natural unfolding. So a few points about upsides and downsides, or strengths and weaknesses of the two approaches. So the path, the positives, it's got a sort of clarity and structure to it. So we know where we are and we know where we're going. There's no ambiguity. There's a sort of precision there. And it's also rigorous. It's a complete path, so it's not missing anything out. Which means, on the one hand, we get to learn all the stages. And on the other hand, we also get to have a look in all the places. So we might think, oh, well, there's not any pretty going on, so that one's not relevant. But actually, if we look, we spend a few minutes tuning the radar in and just being open to that arising, we might find, oh, actually, there is something there. It's just more subtle than I realised. So we familiarise ourselves with all aspects of practice, and we sort of have a look comprehensively at all aspects of our experience. But it's got its downsides, downsides too. So in particular, the stage that we're practicing, if we go through a path model, someone rings a bell, okay, stage 5, here I go. It might not fit our experience. So we might have the sense of dissonance of we're trying to do this, but we're here. It doesn't fit. And so from that, you might get a sense of, well, I'm not doing it right. Or a sense of, I'm trying to fit myself in to a model and I don't fit. Also, there's a sort of goal orientation that's pretty much intrinsic in path approaches, in path models, which can be helpful at the beginning. It can get you motivated, and it can move you from a sort of self-view of, oh, I'm just stuck with this, to a sense of, no, I'm not stuck with it, I can work with it. So it can be useful. But it's got this sort of inherent limitation built in. And the inherent limitation is that we're trying to have a different experience. So it's got that not wanting the experience I'm having, wanting the experience I'm not having. So it's got the sort of those hindrances kind of built into the approach. And there's a tendency to get a bit willful and a bit identified with it. So that's the path, ups and downs. On the mandala model side, so on the upside, there's the freedom there to construct our practice according to our experience. It's not prescriptive, so there's not going to be any sense of dissonance between this is what I'm supposed to be doing, but this is where I'm at. So it's always relevant. And because there isn't this trying to get anywhere, it's got this natural affinity with the sort of quality of relaxing and letting go into experience. Yeah. So that's because you can see in a way that's kind of the opposite. So on the one hand there's the idea of trying to get somewhere, and on the other hand there's a sort of sense of relaxing into where we are. So those are the upsides. It's got its downsides. It's not good at building concentration. There can be a tendency to drift and for one's attention to sort of lack a steadiness and coherence to it. So it's sort of it's building on, it's assuming that we have a stable, attentive state of mind. It's not really the way to build that. Also, it's assuming that we have the sort of intuition to follow our experience, to allow the practice to unfold. So there's a sort of intuitive way of relaxing into and allowing the practice to open and to unfold. So again, it's assuming that's there. If it's not there, we might find ourselves just confused as to what to do, and that can lead to sort of doubt as to, particularly, is this really meditation? So a mandala approach, it's a sort of step in the direction of less structure. So it's a step towards just sitting, which is an approach which has no structure at all. So with the mandala approach, there is structure, but it's kind of more kind of, it's an array of available approaches. It's like a toolbox sort of structure. And you can sort of draw on this and you can draw on that, and you're sort of responding to where you're at in the most appropriate way. But it's less structure, and as you move into less and less structured practice, if there isn't this sort of intuitive sense of how to follow your experience and allow it to unfold, then there might well be a sort of doubt in the sense of, well, is this really meditation at all? I'm just sort of sitting here, what am I doing? So there are the two approaches. And it's good to sort of recognise that they're quite distinct. So each one's got its own value, its own integrity. We may find one more natural or more appropriate at any particular time. And we can sort of, you know, there are two options we can draw. So it's useful to learn the language of each. In terms of Subhuti's three myths of the spiritual life, the path associated with the language of the self-development model. Whereas the mandala is much more using the language of self-discovery. and it's possible to combine the two into an effective practice. Perhaps think of this as more sort of an overall practice, can draw on a self-development model, that can draw on a self-discovery model, perhaps at different times. It's also worth noticing that different teachers are going to emphasise different approaches. They're going to be teaching something particular, which might be more of a path approach, or it might be more of a mandala approach. So it doesn't imply there's a contradiction, they're just alternatives. Okay, so in terms of, well, so what do I do if I want to actually meditate using a mandala approach? How do I do that? Well, if you're doing it in a collective context, basically, disregard any input from the meditation teacher. They're leaving the practice, try and just let that wash over you. And just use the bells as an indication of how the time's progressing. So rather than as an indication of, oh, we're in this stage, we should be doing that, just an indication of, okay, 5 minutes in, okay, 10 minutes in, right. It's sort of best, well, the mandala approach is best supported with no interval bells and no input. So you can follow your own intuition. Perhaps just one a little bit before the end to allow you an opportunity to sort of draw things to a close. Okay. So I'd like to introduce a mandala practice today, but I'm thinking let's do that at the end because it's more akin to the sort of receptive just sitting after more active practice. So I thought the first meditation we could do before the tea break would be more of a path model, but a sort of condensation of practice down into just four stages rather than 16. So I'm going to say a bit about how to condense the practice. because 16 stages is too many, really. They'd be very short. And there are a number of different ways in which we could condense a practice down. So I'm just going to describe one, but hopefully I'll sort of communicate something a bit more by way of the way in which we condense a practice. So there are other ways of doing it that you might come up with yourself. Okay, so we're condensing the practice, drawing on the natural affinity between the different stages. So here's one suggestion that's akin to the normal four-stage mindfulness of breathing, followed by a period of just sitting. So in this suggestion, we'd start with stages one and two in order to establish concentration. So if you remember, stages one and two, we always do them together. Breathing in long, I know I breathe in long. Breathing in short, I know I breathe in short. Breathing out long, I know I breathe out long. Breathing out short, I know I breathe out short. So we're not trying to breathe long or short, we're just kind of recognising the length, the duration of the breath. And also the quality, the texture, and the location of the breath. So this is a good two stages to establish concentration. And here I'm sort of suggesting it's a bit akin to the first two stages of the four-stage mindfulness of breathing where we count. But it's only akin in the sense that it's a stage of establishing concentration. So there's no suggestion of introducing a count. What we're doing is we're sort of investigating quite actively aspects of the quality and the texture of our experience, engaging our attention, bringing the attention to, keeping the attention on. So it's like we're engaging vitaka, turning mind towards, and vichara, bearing mind, turning over in mind. And then in stage two, the suggestion is, well, let's go on to the third contemplation, aware of the whole body I breathe in, aware of the whole body I breathe out. And that's quite akin to, the third stage of the normal fourth stage mindfulness of breathing, with this very open centre of attention. So here the attention's a little bit more open even than the whole breath is, the whole body. And I'll just mention the other two. So from there, refining the concentration. So here we're looking at contemplation 11, concentrating the mind I breathe in, concentrating the mind I breathe out. So we're introducing this very fine point of focus, balancing that with the broad awareness that we've developed. And we're sort of raising the bar with a level of focus, with a level of concentration, and seeing if we can do that without getting tight. And so that's very akin to the fourth stage of the usual fourth stage mindfulness breathing, particularly if you pick this point on the end of the nose. And then, so here, the last stage of our condensed practice is contemplation 12, liberating the mind. I breathe in, liberating the mind, I breathe out. So if you remember, the suggestion in this stage is we're open to all of experience, and it's a bit akin to a just sitting stage at the end of a mindfulness of breathing practice. You're sort of opening to all experience and seeing it as it is. So there's the condensation of the practice. So in the first stage we do contemplations 1 and 2. In the second stage we do contemplation 3, throughout the whole body. In the third we do contemplation 11, concentrating the mind. And then the last stage we do contemplation 12, liberating the mind. So what about the rest of the practice? In what way are we condensing that in? Well, the sort of openness of aware of the whole body, breathe in, aware of the whole body, I breathe out, is also an openness to the feeling tone of experience. So we're sort of wrapping the Vedana tetrad in there. And there can be an element here of just bringing in what's relevant. So if Priti and Sukha are there, we're sort of aware of those and aware of the way in which they're shaping the mind. If hindrances are there, then we're sort of welcoming those in and we're bringing awareness to them. So in that way, we're sort of wrapping in into this open, grounding, embodied awareness. We're wrapping in awareness of feelings, the feeling tetrad, but also experiencing the mind, awareness of, if we're in hindrance, just recognising that. So not just physical sensations, but also their feeling tone and emotions, volitions that are there. And then the last tetrad, contemplating impermanence, fading away, cessation, relinquishment, relaxing into that state of mind that's comfortable with impermanence. It sort of naturally flows from this just sitting approach in liberating the mind. So liberating the mind is just being open to all of the experience and seeing it as it is. So there's a curious relationship between stage 12 and then the next tetrad, stage 13, 14, 15, 16. In a way, it's kind of all there in stage 12. It's sort of reminding me of this aspect of the mandala approach to practice. That I don't think I said this earlier, actually, but one aspect of the one way of looking at the mandala approach to practice is you sort of start at the end. So you kind of assume, so in a mindfulness practice, you sort of assume that, okay, I'll just assume that the mind is settled and attentive and aware, and I'll just sit with this settled, attentive awareness. And if it turns out that, no, actually, there's a hindrance going on, then I'll respond to that appropriately. And if it turns out that, actually, yeah, there are all these lovely dhyana factors arising, then I will bring awareness to that, you know. So you sort of, in a way, you start at the end, and if that's not happening, then you respond to what is happening. To take another example, supposing I'm taking a mandala approach to the metta bhavana practice, then what I'd do is I'd start with stage 5. I'd just sit, radiate metta to the whole world. And if that's not happening because I'm kind of preoccupied with this person that's really getting me, then, ah, okay, stage four is what's happening. So I kind of bring in the stage that's relevant. And that was just going to mind in relation to liberating the mind in stage 12, but then there's this whole tetrad, which is really about liberating the mind. So you can sort of see that in a similar way. We're sort of, in stage 12, liberating the mind, we're kind of assuming, okay, the mind is settled, it's concentrated, and just kind of turn that settled and concentrated awareness to the nature of my experience. I'm just going to sit with that in a way that's kind of jumping right in. And then, well, if actually there's something a bit more kind of structured needed, there's this whole final tetrad, contemplating impermanence. It's in a way that's a sort of, stage 12 you can think of as a sort of relaxing into awareness of the nature of experience. Okay. So there's this dynamic of establishing and then relaxing into. So 11, 12 we've got establishing concentration, relaxing into awareness of the nature of my experience with a concentrated mind. So we're sort of jumping it right in there into the Vipassana process. And if something a bit more structured turns out to be needed there, then stage 13 is kind of bringing a bit of structure back in. Okay, contemplating impermanence, perhaps in a more directed sort of way, more establishing that particular contemplation, that particular awareness of the experience, of the impermanence of our experience, and then relaxing into the momentum of letting go that flows from that. Okay. So that's a way of sort of unpacking or saying more about how the whole last tetrad really kind of folds into liberating the mind. One of the things Prakasha said is you could see another way of looking at condensing the practice. You could condense it all down to 11 and 12. You develop as much concentration as you can, as much samatha as you can, and then you just open to the Vipassana process. So the whole practice, or indeed any Dharma practice we're doing really, you could see in terms of we're just establishing as much samatha as we can, and then we're just opening to the nature of our experience, to this Vipassana process. Yeah. So that pattern of establishing, relaxing into, that's a very key pattern that's there all the way through the practice. And if we're kind of condensing the practice, that's a way of the repetition of that pattern suggests a way of condensing the practice. So if we've still got that pattern in the condensed practice, then we've still got the heart of the Anapanasati in there. Okay. So my suggestion is we'll try a four-stage condensed practice, a bit more led, before tea break. And then after the tea break, we'll have a mandala practice, which will be... I'll just drop in some suggestions, and then it'll be unled, because you can't really lead a mandala practice. That's a contradiction in terms.
Radical.
So, any questions before we have a go at a condensed practice?
I think it's great how you have described the path and the mandala practice. Is there any merit, is there a logic that says to actually start with path practice would eventually help make mandala practice more, I hate the word, but successful, because you're more familiar with the stages?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. The path is very good at familiarising you with all of the stages.
Okay.
So that's actually a good reason for following the path. So to take a metta-bhavana as an example, so some people get, you know, very into the first stage and they wind up just doing the first stage.
Yeah.
But one thing you don't get if you do that is you don't get an equal experience of all the different stages.
Yeah.
And with perhaps it's particularly relevant, particularly challenging with the 16 stages of the Anapanasati. That's an awful lot to be familiar with. So it's going to take a certain number of more sort of disciplined spending time on each stage to do that.
When I first met Divan at Butterfield, he was talking about Anapanasati, and there was somebody in the tent there saying their daily practice was to do 32 minutes, which was 2 minutes of each.
2 minutes of each, yeah. They're a bit short, really. I think it's probably more helpful to think, right, in this practice, I'm going to focus on these, on this aspect.
Yeah.
So what I had in mind next week was to lead two meditations.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one would be straightforwardly going through the first two tetrads in sequence, which is actually seven stages because the first two come together. And then in the second practice, what I thought was we could start with stage three, so we're starting with a open, grounding, embodied presence. And then moving from there into experiencing the mind. So if there are hindrances present, we're moving to to working with hindrances. But we're also moving from an awareness of body to an awareness of mind as permeating the body, as embodied. And then from there through stages, or gladdening the mind, concentrating the mind, liberating the mind, and the last tetrad. So again, that's one extra stage. But the last three stages, really, I thought I'd sort of wrap them into one, in the sense of, to the extent to which there is a momentum of letting go, you're just kind of allowing that to unfold, so you can sort of take the last three stages as one, fading away, cessation and relinquishment. So that, again, that's seven stages. So you could do 5 minutes a stage on that, which is a decent chunk.
It's just helpful that this is addressing the thing about how much you have to or not have to steer your attention, because you know, the path model encourages you to, doesn't it, really, to whatever.
Generally a path model word, yeah. And in there there's the pitfall of control and willfulness. And the challenge of finding a way of engaging with a path model that isn't controlling and willful.
So that's I was going to ask you about that. So it's great, because you can now come up with a load of options as well.
So if you are doing the stages in sequence and following the path model, well, the way of trying to do that in a not controlling, not willful sort of way involves trying to find that sense of direction in your experience, you know, particularly in the body, I think. So I think the body does hold not just a sense of where I'm at now, but also a sense of direction. You know. So it's got a sense of a next step. You know. I don't think it has a sense of three steps down the line, but it has a sense of the next step is this way. And there's, I think there's so much in the opening parallel of establishing posture and then relaxing into posture, because that's so physical and just clear when you're relaxing out of posture that you've dropped out of posture, but there's the difference is so clear. But the parallel also seems very direct with establishing awareness and then relaxing into that awareness. So there's this direction which I do think you can find in your actual embodied experience, which is the way of relaxing into the practice.
That sort of answers a sort of bit of confusion I was thinking around. I think when you said we can assume a position of concentration with that straight away.
Oh, this is the mandala approach, yeah.
Yeah, and I...
well, I just meant to assume...
I'm thinking, well, how?
Yeah.
But then by what you've just said about assuming posture and being in your body, then because I was thinking, well, I'd have to do the breathing, I'd have to be watching my breathing first before I could establish.
Right. I just realised that assume is an ambiguous word. I hadn't realised that.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
yeah.
I could say I assume a good posture.
Yeah.
Which means I put in place.
Yeah.
But what I meant by assume was more. I suppose more like anticipate. You know.
Oh, okay. So sort of.
Do I assume that I'm in a hindrance, or do I assume?
Assume that I'm.
Not, that I'm,
you know, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think I sort of partly got that.
Yeah.
But then was thinking, I'll have to go. Definitely have to be somehow almost calm my body before I get to that point. But I can understand that.
That's sort of, again, that's an assumption. So
yeah.
I'm assuming that I'm not calm. What's the opposite of calm? Sort of restless. So.
Restless.
So I'll need to do something to calm my body.
Yeah.
What I'm inviting you to do is assume that you're calm.
Yeah.
And it might turn out that actually I'm restless, but it might not.
Okay, that's really interesting because it shows me that I probably sit down with the assumption I'm going to be restless.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's been a very common experience for me, but it may not actually be the case.
It may not, yeah. And the thing
really
is, it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I can see that. That's really interesting. Yeah.
Okay, shall we give it a go?
Yeah.